From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week in Russia, a group of journalists took control of a TV station, but not by force. The owner, an exiled businessman, happily handed over the reins of TV6 to Yevgeny Kiselyov, a star news anchor who just quit his post at the country's most prominent network, NTV. Now, NTV was once hailed as Russia's most independent station, alternately easy and tough on President Boris Yeltsin. Vladimir Putin replaced Yeltsin, and NTV was taken over by the state-controlled gas company, Gazprom. That's why the journalists, led by Kiselyov, fled NTV and took up residence at TV6.
But what of NTV? Its former owner, Vladimir Gazinsky, has been drummed out of Russia. Its new boss is an American businessman with Russian heritage, Boris Jordan. Jordan vowed to keep the station independent, and he's had roughly 4 months to prove it. Matthew Brzezinski, longtime observer of Russia and author of the book Casino Moscow, joins us now. Matthew, welcome to OTM.
Hi.
If the Russian economy is correctly described as Casino Moscow, then I guess Boris Jordan is Bugsy Siegel. He built it, right?
He certainly was the poster child for the boom in the mid to late 90s. He was Russia's greatest cheerleader. And I think you're right, more than any other Westerner, he was responsible for many of the billions of dollars that then got sunk into this great Ponzi scheme or pyramid, which naturally, you know, went bust.
Born on Long Island of Russian heritage, his family had been aristocratic family in Russia before the revolution. When he returned, was it as an entrepreneur looking to make a buck, or was it some sort of family destiny?
Clearly, Jordan didn't do this just for the $5,000 a month salary that Gazprom was paying him. And that would hardly fill up the tank on the yacht that he keeps moored in the Long Island Sound. He's an extremely wealthy man. The rumors around Moscow is that the reward he will be given for this is an oil company. And as you know, oil is tremendously big business and very lucrative.
So if there's a Russian oil company in his future, then it would be easy to surmise that he's just completely in the pocket of Vladimir Putin.
I wouldn't go that far. I think Boris Jordan has always played for Boris Jordan and for Boris Jordan only. I think he's very smart and he realizes that if he's discredited with Western investors, then his future lies in Russia. And, of course, the one asset that Russia really has is natural resources. And the best way to get to Russia's natural resources is to do favors for the government, which is in a position to do favors for him.
He protests the way he's operating NTV is a reflection only of his desire to be a manager. From a distance, how does it look? Is NTV being used as a tool of Putin propaganda, or are they playing it pretty straight?
They're doing it subtly. You're seeing progressively greater and greater changes in the sort of coverage. There's far, far less criticism of the Kremlin. Stories which before might have been leading off the broadcast and to which maybe 5 minutes would have been devoted to are now buried at the bottom. You're seeing very sort of strange Soviet-style occurrences and segments, for instance, during the recent May 9th Victory Day celebrations. This is a great holiday for the Russians. This is their victory over fascist Germany in World War II. And you had footage out of Grozny, out of Chechnya, of Chechen children dancing around monuments to Russian soldiers. This is the very same Chechen children who thousands have been orphaned by the Russian army, laying flowers in wreaths at the foot of these monuments to Russian soldiers. You know, this is the sort of thing that you would have never, ever seen on NTV before, and now you do. Sort of thing you would have seen on state television, but NTV wouldn't have touched with a 10-foot pole. Yevgeny Kiselyov, who's sort of the Dan Rather of Russia, he was the former anchor at NTV, and he quit the day that Jordan took over. You know, what he told me was, look, this sends a message to every single editor, newspaper owner, or television or radio station manager across the country that don't cross the party line because we will put you out of business.
So in the end, will Boris Jordan be regarded as some sort of Tokyo Rose with an oil company?
I don't think that history will treat someone like Boris very well. It's clear that just as Russians are being asked to sort of make a deal with the devil and give up freedom for order, I think that Boris has made his own deal with the devil, which in this case is the Kremlin.
Very well. Matthew Brzezinski, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Matthew Brzezinski is the author of Casino Moscow and most recently a New York Times Magazine piece on the resurgence of the KGB.
A recent poll suggests most Russians don't care much about the situation at NTV. On the Media's Alicia Zuckerman was in Moscow recently and asked Anton, who once did some PR work for NTV, about this national tendency toward apathy.
I think that the words I will say, they will sound in a very communist and very bad way. But the Russia has much more heavy problems than a threat to democracy. And this problem is disorder. I understand Putin very well. I'm afraid that if I was on his place, probably I would react in the same way.
The former owner of NTV and the current owner of TVS are what the Russians call oligarchs. Very rich men who support free speech as long as it doesn't hurt their business interests. That was the closest thing to free speech Russia achieved under Yeltsin. Under Putin, those men have been chased from the scene, and according to Paul Goebel of Radio Free Europe, the Russian government now controls virtually all the electronic media from which Russians get their news. But Anton, as we just heard, is not unlike most Russians in his ambivalence. A poll taken at the beginning of this year shows that 57% of all Russians favor the reintroduction of censorship, up from only 10% a few months earlier. The Russian people, veterans of convulsive and dangerous times, seem to fear disorder more than they value press freedom. Are they right? We'd like to hear what you think. Please send your thoughts to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
At 6 a.m. Monday morning, CNN relaunches its nearly 20-year-old stepchild, CNN Headline News. The network has been redesigned with spiffier graphics and jazzed-up music, composed by Stephen Arnold. He joins us in the studio with guitarist Kevin Affleck and vocalist Kelly Brown. Stephen, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
What's the difference between news music and other theme music?
I think news music has an element of rhythm to it, and there's a fast change within a newscast, and even within a several minutes of a newscast, you can often go from something that's warm and fuzzy to something that's very traumatic, train wrecks to babies being born. And the music has to have a certain amount of emotion to it to help support those things, but at the same time, it can't compete. It needs to kind of be there and just help set the tone.
All right, well, let's start by listening to the existing CNN theme.
I call it kind of Velveeta. And so they're looking for a younger demographic, a younger audience, and they wanted the music to reflect that younger audience. So they wanted to hippify it, so to speak. So,
all right, I can't stand it anymore. Can we hear this thing?
Kevin, can you play the logo just on the guitar? So pretty amazing, huh?
Yeah, and let me ask you a question. Would you call that Sharp Cheddar, Monterey Jack, Stilton? What do you think?
You know, it has to work in every genre known to man, unlike what I call real music.
It has to work for Columbine, and it has to work for Jeannie Moss on a unicycle.
There you go. So one of the things that's interesting, I don't know if this you want to hear this thing now, or we have a Kelly Brown, who's a singer. And it's very unusual to have a vocal in a news package. In fact, I've never put a vocal in an actual news package in all my years of doing this. And we've incorporated it into some of the themes as more of a texture. As it plays now, nothing but a voice and acoustic guitar, but it'll give you kind of an idea of the two different type of things that are incorporated in this package.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, Mr. Stephen Arnold and Headline News Unplugged.
Yeah. Hey, oh,
Well, that's not Velveeta. It has kind of a writhing quality to it. Is that going to pass the Columbine test?
Yeah, I think there's enough. There's close to 60 different themes in this package, so law of averages said there's something in there for that, you know.
So using the same basic melody, they can have a sting of for whatever mood is called for.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin, play something real kind of pensive, reflective with that, or something just like in a minor kind of a thing. And you can, and that logo would flip, you know, right on top of that.
Have you played this for any of the journalists at CNN yet? Any reaction from them?
You know, I've been to Atlanta. We started the process almost 6 months ago, and I've been there half a dozen times, and it's very almost overwhelming. Everybody is so complimentary, and so it's, we've gotten really favorable feedback. People are humming it, and as far as the internal people, and you know, at CNN.
Stephen Arnold, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
We've heard Catastrophe and we've heard Pensive. Can you take us out on Jeannie Moss on a unicycle?
Well, now that'll keep you humming.
Yeah, but she's on a unicycle. Don't you have something sprightlier and wittier?
It's kind of, yeah. Well,
oh, no, that's roller skates, right?
Yeah, that's tough. That's totally roller skates.
Coming up, a visit to Haiti, where free speech comes at a high cost, a critic who reports his free gifts from publicists, and a sales pitch from beyond the grave.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm still Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And I am not a critic, though sometimes I wish I were. The critic biz comes with some considerable perks. Tickets and trips, star encounters, and all the little goodies that cram the mailbox from publicists desperate for the good word. John Doyle is TV critic for Toronto's Globe and Mail, and he lists all those charming little bribes in his column under the heading Graft Alert. He lists the market value of the T-shirts and the CDs, the clocks, the meals, and then donates the items to a local food bank. Mr. Doyle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Aren't there limits on the value of the gifts you can accept anyway?
Well, yes, there are. I mean, for as far as the Globe and Mail is concerned, if it's anything more than a token gift, you know, $1 or $2, maybe $5 worth, it shouldn't be accepted at all. The Television Critics Association, which is the umbrella organization for TV critics in Canada and the United States, passed a rule about 3 years ago that the American networks were not to give us gifts unless it was directly related to a program. So the most we get now from Fox or NBC or whomever is a book, if the show is based on a book, or a CD if there's a soundtrack. I think that's a very good policy. But there will always be publicists who try to go a little bit farther to get your attention.
Are there any gifts that impress you with their creativity?
Well, occasionally I'm tempted by some of the toys. And one of the things that everybody picked up on was when I wrote about an itchy and scratchy watch. Now, I don't write a lot about children's television, so I'm not even sure what itchy and scratchy is. But I had offers from readers. They were offering $40, $50, $60 to take the itchy and scratchy watch off my hands. But in general, no, I'm not impressed by this stuff. It's just silly.
Have you had any feedback from the gift givers themselves? Are they offended that you would be exposing the crass tactics that they take to influence opinion?
Yes. It's been a very interesting reaction, actually. Here in Canada, when I wrote about it most recently for the Canadian Press Tour Week, one of the broadcasters reacted with fury that their gift, which they claimed was in all innocence, was being written about. In one instance in the past, a publicist enclosed a $5 bill to say that I could donate it to any charity or food bank of my choice. Now, I really prefer that she didn't do that kind of thing, because sending money in the mail is a bad idea anyway, but I could see that she was actually getting into the spirit of it, and I think that's the best policy.
Oh, you're saying that they really ought to just send you the money?
No, it would be best if they just sent the money to charity instead of sending it to me and other critics who can well afford to buy their own toys and gifts and whatever.
Is there a correlation, even an inverse relationship perhaps, between the value of the gift and the quality of the program?
I think you might be right, actually. The publicists, the PR people, are not stupid about this kind of thing. They often know when they have a dud on their hands. And in order to get attention for it, they will try to be creative or are extremely generous in the gifts they send out.
Well, they spend an awful lot of money on this sort of thing. Are you saying that these little gifts and prizes really have no impact on the critical reaction to their programs?
I don't think so in the long run. I think anybody worth their salt who's writing about television is not going to be influenced by the gifts. There may be people down the food chain, to put it crudely, who work for smaller papers, smaller publications, who are not very well paid, who actually appreciate the gifts.
Well, let's travel the food chain all the way down to the public. Do you think that if the networks sent hats and pens and itchy and scratchy watches directly to viewers, that might convince them to watch some of these shows?
In some instances, it might, because the shows are that bad. In the case of most television shows, the money would simply be better spent on the budget, or maybe on paying the writers more, instead of giving gifts to people who write about the shows.
Well, Itchy's hand is on the 5, which tells me we've gone on too long.
Yes, well, I don't have my itchy and scratchy watch to confirm that with you. That's with the appropriate department at the Globe and Mail and will be auctioned off in due course.
John Doyle, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Doyle is the television critic for the Toronto Globe and Mail.
Since the mid-90s, Haitian journalists have been trying to forge a free press. But that freedom was threatened last year when reporters were subjected to a round of death threats. It culminated in the spring of last year with the killing of Jean-Dominique, a national gadfly and hero of Haitian radio.
Some of the accused tried to cast suspicion on his widow and co-host, Michelle Montas, who was not with him as she usually was on the morning he died. Still, she is doing all she can to push the investigation forward, despite the challenges posed by Haiti's fledgling democracy. On the Media's Marianne McCune produced this piece for us in March, and she'll be back with us in a few minutes with an update.
Michelle Montas says she believes in love at first sight. It happened to her one evening in 1972, the first time she saw Jean-Dominique.
I go to first movie, I see him. I go to second movie, I see him. I go to third movie, which I love to do, go see 3 movies in a row. I go to third movie and here he is again. I said, that man is crazy.
29 years later, as the first streams of sunlight creep in among the purple bougainvillea bordering her garden, Montas climbs out of bed, says goodbye to the photograph on her nightstand, and takes her morning coffee alone, facing the front door. She awaits the arrival of a car full of gunslinging government bodyguards to back up the two with her at all times. Only then will she drive through the gates of Radio Haiti-Inter into the parking lot where, one morning almost a year ago, she rushed to her husband's aid, too late to hear his last words. In the on-air studio across from her engineer, Montas leans bony elbows on the table under a bigger-than-life black-and-white photograph of Jean-Dominique. His voice still opens the morning news show.
It's 7 o'clock. To all, I say good morning.
Bonjour, Jean. Bonjour à tous. Nous sommes aujourd'hui le lundi.
She raises her eyes between phrases, as if speaking to someone in the room. It's been 326 days, she says, since a journalist who at times risked his life so others could gain the right to speak was assassinated in the courtyard of this radio station. It's been 326 days since a free man fell.
Each time you enter this radio station, the first thing that hits you is that Jean was murdered here.
Gregory Casimir is one of the dozen or so journalists who work with Montas.
And that you could be another victim.
Jean-Dominique and Michel Montas reported the news through far more nerve-wracking times in Haiti. During the 1970s and 80s, under the dictatorial regimes of the Duvaliers, Radio Haiti was one of the single sources of news to push beyond official public statements. To avoid being closed down, reporters approached their stories indirectly, for example, using Nicaragua as a metaphor for Haiti.
We couldn't talk about the eventual fall of Jean-Claude Duvalier, but we could talk about the fall of Somoza. The Sandinista song was played on our airwave. We had a reporter in Managua.
Montas had studied journalism at Columbia University in New York, but found reporting in Haiti was not the objective craft her professors would have had her believe. It was a battle. After the fall of Jean-Claude Duvalier in 1986, that battle was for free democratic elections. But by the night before, Haitians were to cast their ballots the following year. Fires set by the military burned across Port-au-Prince.
The culprits are believed to be a loose alliance of Duvalier loyalists.
Victoria Corderi of CBS News.
Blamed for the months of violence.
Montas and her team watched in frustration from the station's roof until they found they themselves were being shot at.
There was that feeling that whether you are a journalist or not, it's called rage. There were some rocks on top of that roof. We picked them up and started throwing the rocks. And it was, I have to say, extremely enjoyable to see armed men running. One of them dropped his gun.
Most of the radio stations have been sabotaged. The radio is a unifying force here.
It was 1990 before Haitians finally did get to vote. That was a victory for Radio Haiti. Dominique supported the election of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He told listeners he was for Aristide's party, called La Valas. But Dominique never stopped battling. And neither has his station. They've covered the poisoning of 70 children from faulty cough syrup and the push to prosecute the owner of the company at fault. They've reported on corruption among Haitian officials and businessmen and on the U.S.'s refusal to extradite the Haitian leader of a paramilitary group. Among those Dominique slammed in his commentaries were Haiti's most powerful. Now some are suspects in his murder.
The truth always makes the face of the devil blush.
Jean-Dominique's voice is still ubiquitous on Radio Haiti. In a daily promotional spot, he tells listeners,
"They have tried everything to sink us, to electrocute us, to drown us, to seduce us. This has lasted more than 50 years. Is there a reason it should stop? Yes, one. Things must change in Haiti."
Whether Haiti can put Jean-Dominique's killer on trial is a test of just how much the country has changed. The judge charged with investigating his murder travels through Port-au-Prince, followed not only by a police van, but by a government SWAT team. Of the half dozen who've been arrested so far, one died mysteriously on an operating table. Of the 70 called for questioning, some are finding ways to resist. A Lavalas senator, against whom evidence is piling up, says he's willing, but his Senate colleagues are debating whether he has immunity.
When democracy was restored in the fall of 1994, the justice system was absolutely in shambles.
Brian Concannon's group of international attorneys is working for the Haitian government.
Throughout its history, the people running the system had always taken the sides of whoever had the guns and the money.
Concannon says in this case, top officials have assured him there are no untouchables, but Haitians don't believe the government can or will investigate.
So someone might have information that if they were sure that their information would put the person in jail, they would give it, but they're not sure that's going to happen, and they're afraid of antagonizing somebody.
Local journalists are certainly skeptical that a killer will be found and punished, especially those who've themselves been threatened with death or damage to their stations in the past year and believe the ruling party is responsible. When a station called Radio Kiskeya referred repeatedly to last year's parliamentary elections as rigged, they found a warning next to the front door.
That's where someone left a gallon of gas.
Marvel Dandin is co-founder of the station.
They were saying, we can burn you down.
The facade of another radio station, Vision 2000, is punctured with small holes after protesters shouting slogans of the ruling party pelted it with rocks.
There are three holes. There's that, and there's a third.
Station owner Leopold Berlanger is a wealthy supporter of the opposition.
These days, police can cross their arms and do nothing. Who's responsible? Are they following an order from someone powerful? We don't know. And our leaders say nothing. They close their mouths.
In January, just before President Aristide was newly inaugurated, a list of people suspected of favoring the opposition was read over government air. Two journalists were named, one a Radio Kiskeya host.
They said that the people on this list need to explain themselves or they will be killed.
Though a government flak denounced the reader, no one seemed to claim responsibility for the list. Two reporters at Vision 2000 fled to Canada last year. Radio stations have closed for days or weeks at a time. Some reporters sleep in a different bed every night.
If you knew that, okay, it was the government, it was the police chief, it was a minister, maybe when you are reporting the news, you know how to present it. But now you don't know who, and you don't know which news will bother who.
Newspaper reporter Guy Delva recently revived the Association of Haitian Journalists, disbanded during the military coup of 1991.
When press freedom exists, now it can be threatened.
Delva's aim is to get journalists to stand together against threats, but the journalists themselves are divided. Berlanger's Vision 2000 is funded by wealthy investors who support opposition leaders. It's even rumored to receive American money. People say Guy Delva of the Association of Haitian Journalists is an even-handed reporter, but they also say he's on the government payroll.
A few years ago, you know, it was when you had money, you know, you buy yourself a bank. Now you buy yourself a media, a radio station.
Radio stations and newspapers are themselves political players, reminds Michel Montas, whose station has received death threats from all sides. The media are enmeshed in the same violent culture that plagues Haitian politics. They grew up under Duvalier's strong-arm tactics and machete-bearing Tonton Macoutes.
I don't think it is amazing in any way that you have a little bit of the Macoute left in the mentality of a lot of Haitians, whatever the political parties. You don't overthrow mentalities overnight.
The threats will go away, says Montas, only when the justice system has squeaked into action.
A crime is punished. You have to pay for it. That notion does not exist in Haitian society.
Il est 7 heures. À tous, je dis bonjour.
Bonjour Jean, bonjour à tous.
There is a myth that Jean-Dominique loved, says Montas. The myth of Sisyphus, condemned by the gods to roll a boulder up a mountain.
It didn't matter to Sisyphus that the rock was going to roll down again after he had brought it up the mountain. What mattered was the shape of the rock, was the way the rock felt under your hands, was the effort of pushing it.
Michel Montas may not know whom she's fighting, but she knows what she's fighting for. Backing down now, she says, would make her an assassin in the second murder of her husband. For On the Media, I'm Marianne McCune.
And Marianne is back with us now in the studio.
So how is the investigation going several months hence?
Well, it continues to be plagued by delays. As the lead judge investigating the case got closer and closer to an indictment, he and some of the journalists reporting on the issue were feeling more and more under pressure. In June, just as he submitted his recommendations to the government for approval, he fled the country, saying he was too much in danger. His report was rumored to include the indictment of a very, very prominent senator, someone Jean-Dominique had thoroughly criticized a few months before his murder. But nothing could be done with the report in his absence, so that stalled any action for a while. Since then, he's returned to Haiti and is back on
the
case.
The judge has.
The judge, Judge Gasson, has returned to Haiti and is back on the case, but he's still facing many obstacles. The government has told him to continue the investigation, but Danny Toussaint, the senator many think will be indicted, has accused him of bias, and another investigation into that possible bias may prevent him from further questioning Toussaint. So there seems to be barrier after barrier to getting to the bottom of this case.
How about the pressure on the Haitian press in general? Has that eased up?
I don't think it's eased up particularly. One journalist from Radio Haiti Inter called me from Canada saying he'd become too afraid to stay in the country because of his reporting on the investigation. There are reports that the government is threatening and or buying out stations that would otherwise report critically. So politics in Haiti are so chaotic, it's still difficult to tell who's responsible for trying to control what's said in the press.
Well, Marianne, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Marianne McCune, a reporter for On the Media and for WNYC in New York.
The New York Times reported this week that AT&T Labs has developed speech software that can recreate the voices of long-dead celebrities and have them say anything programmers want them to say. Think of the advertising possibilities.
Think of the poetry.
We did. On the Media presents T.S. Eliot for Toyota.
Between the acceleration and the brakes, between the cylinders and the shaft, between the purchase and the lease, falls the Camry. For thine is the green one. For thine is... car is, for thine is the... This is the way the Toyotathon ends. This is the way the Toyotathon ends. This is the way the Toyotathon ends. Not with a whimper, but with 0.9% APR financing on all new cars and trucks.
Coming up, we celebrate the 80th anniversary of Radio Play-by-Play this week with some thoughts about announcers and advertising and Cracker Jack.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I continue to be Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with some of your letters. Our conversation with incoming Wall Street Journal editorial page editor Paul Jagot elicited this response from Catherine Hodge in Milwaukee. Thank you for challenging Jagot's hypocrisy in his indignation over the Supreme Court ruling in Roe v. Wade, she writes. Certainly the court's manipulation of Florida's role in the presidential election is an example of the sort of judicial fiat he supposedly decries. In contrast, Francis B. Smith, a D.C. resident, thinks we went too hard on him. While Jagot was met with aggressive attack mode questions, New York Times editorial page editor Gail Collins was given warm, fuzzy pussycat questions.
Yeah, and just for the record, Brooke was the aggressive one, I was the pussycat. The prize for the most attentive listener goes to Brian Breaker at the Boston premiere of Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes. Brian heard, in the middle of a simian-on-man fight, the unmistakable sound of the Wilhelm. Yes, the much-celebrated scream, as featured in our piece by Dave Sirchuk. He says, I felt like I was a witness to an elaborate inside joke. I felt in the know. Just doing our job, Brian. Just doing our job.
And here's one for you, Bob. Patrick O'Brien says he appreciated your piece on privacy last week and suggests it should be required reading for anyone with questions regarding privacy issues. Lastly, we received an oddly prescient letter from one Martha Garvey Jr. She says, Brooke and Bob are a wonderful combo, and you clearly have a crackerjack producing staff. Crackerjack. Stay tuned. All will be explained.
Eighty years ago this weekend, the first big league game ever broadcast was carried by radio station KDKA in Pittsburgh. Wes Westrum, the light-hitting catcher for the old New York Giants, once said, "Baseball is like a church. Many attend, few understand." And some of the crankier longtime fans recoil at what they see as the superficial coverage provided by television, where they say gimmicks overshadow the action on the field. On the Media's Rex Doan calls the contest between TV and radio play-by-play.
Hi, neighbor. The Brewers of famous Narragansett Ale and Lager Beer present Big League Baseball. Today's game at Briggs Stadium in Detroit between the Detroit Tigers and the Chicago White Sox will come to you by telegraphic recreation.
Recreations of baseball games on radio, like this one from 1950, may today seem like a charming, if somewhat naive, antiquity. What is truly remarkable, however, are the similarities in play-by-play style over the past several decades. Back when professional football and basketball were in their infancy, Major League Baseball was broadcast to millions of faithful listeners then as now. For Hall of Fame announcer Ernie Harwell, little has changed.
I think the style of radio broadcasters is pretty much the same as it was when I began back in the mid-40s. The TV, of course, is a lot different because of the progress of technology. When we first started on TV, it was very basic, and most of the TV announcers or radio announcers are talking behind a picture. Now you've got replays and so many gimmicks that are technical advances that it's changed the technique.
For Sports Illustrated senior writer Steve Rushen, it's the continuity that play-by-play on radio has with its past that is a large part of its appeal.
It's not simply vivid description from the better play-by-play people, but oftentimes, much more so than they do on TV, they let the action, or in the case of baseball, often the inaction, speak for itself. I'd like nothing more than the pauses they have on the radio where you can just hear the crowd noise in the background, maybe the sound, the crack of the bat, or the pop of the catcher's mitt.
Curve is low inside, ball two. 2-0.
For baseball purists like Rushen, the unfettered presentation of the game is a premium.
I think it's interesting that the first broadcast was in 1921, and there have been 80 years of technology since then. And television, you went from basically the invention of television to today's flat screen plasma projection, you know, stereophonic surround sound TVs tricked out with all of the graphics you see on a Fox broadcast, the catcher cam and the quick cuts and the score constantly running at the bottom of the screen. It seems to have not so much added anything as it has detracted or distracted viewers from seeing the game. And I think that radio, which has changed hardly at all in many ways since 1921, is still the best way to, quote, see a baseball game.
But not everyone is ready to toss out their TV remote. For Charlie Pierce, a writer-at-large for Esquire magazine and a frequent contributor to NPR's Only a Game, baseball on TV is not inherently evil.
You know, there's a great line from the play A Man for All Seasons where somebody says something in Latin and another person says, how long will we hear this sacred language? And Thomas More very mildly turns to him and says, it isn't sacred, it's just old. And I think that baseball has never quite gotten the distinction between those things that are sacred and those things that are just old. And I think that people who watch baseball on TV now are much better served in their enjoyment of the game.
Rich Sandomir, who covers sports broadcasting for the New York Times, can appreciate the living history of radio play-by-play, but he also sees the merits of the televised games as well.
On television, you can use the tools, the best tools and best graphics, to analyze the strike zone. ESPN's strike zone graphic is a good example of something you can't do on radio. Is it a departure from traditional play-by-play? Yeah, sure it is, but I think done well, it's an enhancement.
But as Charlie Pierce suggests, whether listening to baseball play-by-play on the radio is the best way to appreciate the game isn't the important issue here. Having survived 80 years in a fickle and increasingly restrictive commercial broadcast environment, baseball play-by-play may now in fact be the best way to appreciate radio, a savior of the medium and not just the sport.
When it comes right down to it, baseball play-by-play is really the only place for original broadcasting left on the AM dial. The music, if what music there is all programmed. The talk radio is largely all syndication. Baseball play-by-play is still the only place where you have any freedom to run at all, basically because you are doing essentially live drama.
New baseball thrown into play. Kenny Boyer with the next. One ball, no strike. Musial the hitter. There's Padres getting ready. Now the pitch. Boyer's ball! Boyer's ball!
For On the Media in New York, I'm Rex Jones.
Garfield likes to listen to sports on the radio, and he gets his exercise railing at the commercials.
Listening to an ad on a classical music radio station sounds like this.
It's called the Lexus Golden Opportunity. You have until September 4th to get the one that didn't get away.
Listening to an ad on an all-news radio station sounds like this.
Well, you'll feel even worse tomorrow morning if you miss Sleepy's one-day sale.
Listening to an ad on a baseball game sounds like this.
Hello?
Okie, where are you? We're almost done with warm-ups. You're going to miss BP.
This is better than batting practice, Coach. I'm downloading the opposing pitcher stats.
You mean you don't have Adelphia's power link?
Where is it inscribed that baseball game advertising copy must invoke baseball themes and imagery? Hank Greenwald, retired voice of the San Francisco Giants, spent years reading the worst writing on God's green outfield.
Here are the stolen base leaders in the National League, and this feature is brought to you by some burglar alarm company. Don't let anyone steal your prized possessions, you know, or you'll hit a home run every time when you bank with such and such. They're corny, and a lot of times you kind of cringe when you hear them.
Grand slam this, strike out that. Hockey game ads don't talk about slap shots and cross checks. Traffic report advertising doesn't trot out bumper-to-bumper gags. So how in the world do you explain this?
Swing and a long drive. Watch
I've seen plenty of big hits in my day. No hit, though, could match the one Sue Tierney of Philadelphia made during her family reunion. Sue excited that crowd of aunts, uncles, and second cousins with a grand slam meal of hot dogs and hamburgers served on delicious Stroman rolls. So make a big hit of your own with Stroman hot dog and hamburger rolls.
The voice belongs to Philadelphia Phillies play-by-play man Harry Callis, one of the most admired broadcasters in baseball. Which is one of the reasons the situation is so pathetic. Philadelphia Inquirer sports writer Frank Fitzpatrick not only cringes, but feels a deep and abiding sadness to hear so distinguished an announcer reduced to mouthing such insipid and misinformed blather.
There's one of these ads that's like fingernails on a blackboard to me. It's another Stroman's ad, and Harry says, I've seen many great Phillies teams over the years, and I'm thinking, no, you haven't. I mean, they've only had 5 pennant winners in 117 years.
He's right, of course. The Phillies are by far the losingest franchise in the history of professional sports. But Frank veers off the point, which is that what the hell do great Phillies teams have to do with hot dog buns?
I think most of the imagery is just so cliched that they feel like no matter what bad pun or play on words they
and
make people
forget it, Frank. I'll tell you what it has to do with hot dog buns. It doesn't have anything to do with hot dog buns. At long last, what kind of sensibility is behind this reflexive reference in the advertising to the programming that surrounds it? Pitching stats and cable modems? Who writes this stuff?
Well, obviously, knowing that this was going to be broadcast during the Dodger games, you want that type of a tie-in.
Michael Knight is marketing manager for the Adelphia Cable System's PowerLink high-speed internet service. He doesn't use an ad agency. He himself authored the pitcher spot that Adelphia runs on Dodgers games.
Major sports, say a football and a basketball, which probably wouldn't have come as easy to me to create an ad that would flow. Baseball just has that natural flow to it.
There's your answer. Baseball ads sound the way they do because the likes of Oscar Wilde aren't writing them, nor are the likes of David Ogilvy writing them. Marketing managers of high-speed internet services are writing them. Local radio ads on baseball or anywhere else are the bottom of the advertising food chain, and the author's imagination is usually insufficient to think outside the white chalk lines. But the thing is, you don't have to be peddling cable service or doughy picnic items to sound pitiful in your attempt to hit one out of the park with the consumer. You can be selling the future of New York City.
Hey, when a shortstop drops the ball on a sure double play, he tells you, my error, there's no finger pointing. So how come on a big thing like poor math and reading scores, no one in the school system has ever said, hey, it's my fault? Well, elect Mike Bloomberg mayor. Give him the assignment. He'll be accountable. Mike Bloomberg. He'll deliver. Paid for by Bloomberg for mayor.
I have no idea which candidate would be a better Republican nominee for mayor, but if you want to touch base with someone who doesn't talk to you like you're a moron, fill out your lineup card for Herman Badillo.
There is one consumer item that has no need for an artificially baseball-centric ad campaign. It's all because of a song written in 1908 by a lyricist who had never seen a baseball game. But when Jack Norworth saw a Subway ad for baseball at the Polo Grounds, the lyrics for Take Me Out to the Ball Game hit him with the speed of a Christy Mathewson fastball. And that reference to Cracker Jack translated to free advertising the likes of which America has not seen before or since. How much is that worth to parent company Frito-Lay? Our producer at large, Mike Pesca, found out.
The Yankees beat the Texas Rangers 9-7 at the stadium Wednesday night. The game featured two innings of stellar relief from Mariano Rivera, Tino Martinez's 24th home run of the season, and 41,714 people simultaneously standing and invoking a brand name consumer non-durable. On Wednesday night, as on most nights throughout the summer, thousands of Americans stood up and sang the word Cracker Jack. Last year, over 72 million customers saw a Major League Baseball game, and at a certain juncture in each, they were all invited to participate in the most entrenched product placement in American history.
Cracker Jacks! Cracker Jacks!
It is technically Cracker Jack, not Cracker Jacks, on the box and in the song lyrics. Pluralized or not, Cracker Jack has achieved a singular place in the American psyche, if not consciousness.
So, what do you eat when you come to the ballpark?
Of course you gotta have a hot dog, and you always eat Cracker Jacks.
Why?
Well, because they're just the best.
Why?
It was embedded in your mind that you had to eat hot dogs and Cracker Jacks at baseball.
Why?
Because they told you to do it, so you just do it.
It just fits. You're gonna keep saying why until you give me the right answer. Why?
Okay. Say the answer.
Sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Take me out to the ball game. Wait, we'll have some Cracker Jacks. Yeah, at the old ball game. Yeah.
Peter Broniska and Zanetta Stewart knew that Cracker Jack and baseball went together because the song lyric plants the association in the mind. But that doesn't always lead to direct action. A stadium vendor told me that sales spike in the second and are almost dead by the seventh inning stretch. This was borne out by a visit to the concession stand right after Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
See, right now you're folding. Can you tell me what kind of box you're folding up?
Cracker Jack box.
And is that because you're sold out?
No.
Due to huge demand?
No.
Do you often sell out of Cracker Jacks?
No.
Do you often sell out of anything?
Yes.
What do you sell out of?
Peanuts.
So how much is this mention worth to Cracker Jack? Let's say Cracker Jack wasn't in the song. Let's say instead that there was a Cracker Jack ad on the outfield wall of every major league park. According to Scott McDuffie, vice president of out-of-home media for Zenith Media, those types of ads cost $250,000 each. It's cheaper to advertise in the minors, but there are 160 minor league stadiums. Conservatively, the price to replace the lyric with outdoor advertising in professional baseball stadiums would be $25 million. Cracker Jack's total sales last year were around $40 million. Does this mean that without baseball, there would be no Cracker Jack, or at least no Cracker Jack as we know it?
They may have had some difficulties trying to make Cracker Jack contemporary.
Paul Lucas is the author of Inconspicuous Consumption, An Obsessive Look at the Stuff We Take for Granted. He recalls Cracker Jack's attempts to tweak its brand image through television commercials in the 70s.
I think the lyric of the jingle went something like, "What do you call a kid who can dive like that? You call that kid a Cracker Jack.
You call that kid a Cracker Jack."
You remember, yeah. And then the tagline at the end was, "When you're really good, they call you Cracker Jack." And in fact, no, they don't.
They stopped calling you Cracker Jack during the Hoover administration. And that's one of the reasons why Cracker Jack will remain not only caramel-covered, but sepia-tinged. Paul Lucas.
With snacks, which are sort of in the realm of pop culture when it comes to consumer products, the brand image is at least as important as the product itself. And the image and the look they've gone for with this particular brand is one of nostalgia. And I do think that a lot of it has to do with the song. It's sort of, in some ways, it's great free advertising, but it may also be a bit of a straitjacket.
But Cracker Jack does have one other thing going for it. Yankee Stadium groundskeeper Javon Trehearne has cleaned up hundreds of pounds of Cracker Jack. How long have you been working at Yankee Stadium?
10 years.
10 years. 10 years, how many Cracker Jack prizes have you found on the ground?
None. They don't never throw away the prize. They always keep the prizes.
If Hallmark had gotten in on the ground floor of the writing of Happy Birthday, or if Francis Scott Key could have somehow known to mention, say, Woolite, we'd have another contender for most effective product placement ever. But if Francis Scott Key had been that smart, we'd call him Cracker Jack. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katja Rogers, and Melissa Sanford, engineered by Irene Trudell and Scott Strickland, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Dylan Keefe, Sean Landis, and Kathleen Horan.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And just to reiterate, I'm Bob Garfield.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink. Drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.